The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing and how natural fruits of the olive tree can effectively lower your blood pressure. In our guest segment in the second part of our program, David Sorota. He's an award-winning journalist, investigative reporter, and a commentator on American progressive politics. And we're going to talk about the role of the 1980s. Remember that Jell-O decade? And the values and how they've played in shaping the American political and social landscapes today. On our issues, we have two. The War on Science is now War on Education by Professor Bud Goodall, and then The Myth of Humanitarian Intervention in Libya by Rain in Yemen by Richard Becker. Those are short, but I'd like your input. And yesterday, about 110 people tried to call in and give their point of view. I just watched Until Time to Go on the Air, President Obama's live presentation, I believe it was over at Georgetown University, talking about our whole new vital green blueprint for the environment. And he was very opining about deep water drilling. He's going to do more of that, open up more of our natural lands for the coal industry, do more work with Canada in getting their tar coals down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, bringing more of the oil from Mexico into the United States. A lot more energy on that really super clean, green energy gas. And, of course, not mentioning hydrofracking. And that's his emphasis. What I didn't hear was any of the problems, and also nuclear. I didn't hear any of the problems with any of these industries, how they're not sustainable, they are destructive, and they're all polluting. Nor was there any emphasis really to talk about what we could do to make a difference when it comes to wind, solar, geothermal, and energy wave, where some countries such as China and Germany are way ahead of the United States in their technology, and we could do those with no pollution, no side effects, virtually immediately. So that's what I'll be dealing with. And also, I understand that this morning there was a debate on one of the programs, I didn't have a chance to hear it, where Helen Colicott was being challenged on the real dire consequences of Chernobyl and the radiation emissions and what is a safe level. And there didn't seem to be a citation. I have that citation. I will give that today, showing you that it was 985,000 deaths from Chernobyl. And that information is available from a Dr. Alexei Yablokakov, and author of the article Chernobyl Consequences of Catastrophe for People and the Environment. By the way, he's a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences, and we have that. Let's begin. A lot to cover today. A lot of people in this audience are concerned about those they know who have high blood pressure, as well they should, because high blood pressure can kill you. According to a new article in the published peer-reviewed journal Phytomedicine, they have found that for tens of millions of Americans who are at risk of a sudden death or heart attack or a stroke from high blood pressure, that there are simple phytonutrients that can make a difference. And these would help the vascular network of vessels and arteries, ultimately leading to helping prevent the heart attack, stroke, and vascular dementia. And traditional medicine, natural medicine, calls for the administration of multiple natural nutrients that can help change the biochemistry and not produce damaging side effects. Well, now the latest research shows that 500 milligrams twice a day of olive leaf extract, those are the leaves of the olive tree, can lower your blood pressure naturally and substantially. In fact, to the degree that it's literally better than the stage 1 hypertensive patient's medications, the ACE inhibiting drugs. The study authors noted that extracts from leaves of the olive tree, and by the way, there are multiple types of olives, but it doesn't seem to matter, quote, have been used since ancient times to combat high blood pressure, atherosclerosis, and diabetes for other medicinal purposes. Additionally, the researchers found that the group of subjects taking the olive leaf extract demonstrated significant improvements in their triglyceride levels. That's a very positive benefit not seen in any of the pharmaceutical drugs for similar uses. So, 1,000 milligrams of olive leaf extract each day will do the job for you there. Now, what is the number one destroyer of health? More than pesticides and hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, pizzas, alcohol and smoking. Believe it or not, the number one cause of health being destroyed is stress. According to Mike Bundrant, in an interesting piece I read, they're connecting the stressors in the body to lethal combinations of biochemistry reactions in the body. Heart disease, diabetes, cancer, hypertension, high blood pressure, peptic ulcers, headaches, chronic anxiety, depression, addictive disorders, all of which foster unhealthy lifestyles, are all scientifically linked to chronic stress. In fact, the newest study shows 50 separate conditions are all correlated with high stress lifestyles, even obesity. So, no organ system is immune to the effects of stress. Let me just share with you now a partial synopsis of what happens when you decide to get yourself anxious, angry, depressed, feelings of insecurity, incompleteness, not feeling loved, or projecting vengeance towards others. And I'm going to do a separate program on just that alone, because a lot of people are engaged in that, not realizing what kind of injury they're causing their own body. Hair loss. That's right. Excessive hair loss and premature baldness are linked to stress. With the skin, eczema, psoriasis, hives, excessive sweating, stress. Digestion. Gastritis, colitis, stomach and duodenal ulcers, irritable bowel syndrome, stress. The heart, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, high blood pressure, stress. In your mouth, ulcers and excessively dry mouth. Muscles, tightness, soreness, spasms, aching, lower back pain, twitching, and muscular tics. In your lungs, shortness of breath, panic disorders, and exacerbation of asthmatic conditions. In your brain, stress causes psychological conditions like anxiety, insomnia, depression, irritability, and personality changes, which, by the way, also change perception. Hence, just by being stressed and insecure, you can actually, in your mind, change an event. So what happened, you literally can change what happened, and that is just making stuff up out of whole cloth. People do it all the time. They take something out of context, make it up in their mind, and suddenly it becomes a weapon that they use against others. That's what happens when you're stressed. Stress alters your perceptions. You can no longer tell right from wrong, good from bad, ethical from unethical, moral from immoral. And yet we own both sides. It's called splitting. It's much like the best that your mother ever gave you in love and hugs and kisses and kissing the boo-boos of life and being there for you and happy smiles and wonderful food. That is what we remember the best. Similarly, if a mother is critical about your room isn't neat or you're goofing off or you're doing something you shouldn't, that becomes the bad mother, the mother that is tough to be around, You don't like looking in the eyes if you've done something wrong. What happens is we have this capacity for what is called splitting. And it starts early in life because we can't take the whole complex sin that one person is capable of having, both positive and negative, happy and sad, cheerful and tyrannical behavior. So we split it down the middle and we create one or the other. And that way we can deal with the person. And we do this later in life. That's why a lot of people are in toxic relationships. That's why a lot of people will not see the imbalance in their own life when they're working too hard, but they're making money, so they justify it. Or they feel they're too insecure unless they do have something more, and hence they have to do more to have more. They can't come to grips with this idea that so many people in our world are really suffering from a mass psychosis. Whole generations can suffer from a mass psychosis, where facts are not enough. Just keep this in mind. Facts by themselves do not move people. If facts move people, long ago we would have given up any pretense that vaccines are either safe or effective. The science shows they're neither for any given individual. Long ago we would have given up that HIV by itself causes 30 different life-challenging conditions, including cervical cancer, which is the most absurd anti-scientific statement imaginable. And yet, with all the facts, it doesn't change a single mind. And giving the antiretroviral drugs has caused hundreds of thousands of millions of death. The evidence that the number one cause of death in people taking HIV medication is liver failure, which is not one of the diseases caused by HIV. So if the number one cause of death in people who have diagnosed with AIDS is liver failure, and liver failure is directly tied to the treatment, then what you can say in a completely reasonable, logical, and scientifically rational argument is your treatment is killing the patient. But it won't work because we are not rational beings. We are not moved by rational arguments. We live in such long-lasting delusions that if you're a progressive individual who finally come up outside of that cloud, you look at the world and you say, wow, why don't we have universal health care? A rational argument that we could prevent disease and that by helping people and to prevent disease, educating them what caused disease, then you save all that suffering of the individual and the cost to a society. That will not move a single person to cause a single preventative health program. Keep in mind, those in this audience who are progressives understand that the people most likely to get their points of view across, what to eat, what to wear, what to listen to, what to watch, what movies to go to, have nothing to do with what is in your best interest. They're not rational. They come from tapping into people's mass psychoses and fears. Progressives should never abandon rationality, but they better understand that you better attach some semblance of message to a person's emotions and sense of reason, or you have no influence whatsoever. And so that's why, with 41% of all voters being independent, there is virtually no power of the independents to influence elections today. So just remember, most people in the media, most people watching the media, most people influenced by our social discourses are filled with hateful and incendiary energy from ranters, from Glenn Beck and some of the extremes in the Tea Party, to the virtually unrelenting Rush Limbaugh, who's in your face nonstop. And that creates an endless paranoia on both the left and on the right. And that means then the only way we can deal with life is we have to split it, meaning we split issues down the middle. And therefore, through the dynamics of psychoanalysis seen long ago, we can say, okay, I can deal with this because I'm separating the good person from the bad person, the kind person, the unkind person, the honest person from the betraying person. Hold on, they're both the same person. The person that you will have dinner with today and confide in will be the person who will get home and call their friends and gossip about you later. How can you separate out one person from another? They're the same person. How can you separate out a president who says, I'm for you unions, I'm for the working people, sponsors NAFTA, supports the World Trade Organization, and 3 million American jobs over the next 30 years or 20 years are lost? Well, that's not a... If you looked at the whole person, you'd say, this person's just a pro-corporate elite Democrat. And they pander to our mass psychosis of fear. So when you look at someone, look at them in the totality of who they are. It's like otherwise having a morbidly obese person lead a class on dieting. A bald-headed person on how to grow hair. All right? An angry, resentful, anally retentive person talking about relaxing. Well, and how easy it is that we can separate off the good Glenn Beck from the bad, the good Sean Hannity from the bad, the good Keith Olbermann from the bad. Did I just miss something last night? I cannot be the only person in the United States who saw the suck-ups of the left, Rachel Maddow, and what's his face, the guy who comes on, who replaced Keith Olbermann, and the guy Ed Schultz, and then the other fella, Lawrence O'Donnell, were not. They all supported Obama in his Libyan invasion for a regime change. And how can you possibly not see this as a regime change for oil and getting our people through CIA and other front groups in power to take some of Libya's top generals and other leading business people in the country and make them our new supporters, our new puppets? We don't kill them. We let them keep the bounty of all their theft and their repressive techniques. We don't prosecute them with crimes against humanity, which easily could be done and proven, because they're now our lapdogs, just like all the others throughout the world. How can you not challenge that? Because you fall right into that idea that logic won't change you, reason won't change you, and most importantly, rational argument won't change you, because you separate out. You become a person that takes it right down the middle. And when you do that, just like a splitting that a child does, you now see the good Obama and the compromised Obama, the good war, Afghanistan, and the bad war, Iraq. What's good about Afghanistan? So the next time you try to have a reasonable conversation and you don't get reason in return, understand that you're not dealing with a person who is present in that moment with a mindfulness. You're dealing with a mass psychosis. And that's why you won't be able to get your point across. So when I tell you that stress is hurting every single part of your body, if you're a woman, vaginal infections. Remember the example yesterday? The way I helped a woman cure herself had nothing to do with diet or supplements. It had to do with her stop being so craving to control the outcome, starting early in life when she competed against her younger but more relaxed and joyful and playful and more open to experiencing life sister. Her sister was the darling of her father's eye. And she couldn't stand her sister because of it and competed to show that her sister was a failure because she was the Harvard grad lawyer making the $500,000 a year with the designer suits and the impeccable apartments. And the sister all the while was just a happy person living life in balance, and she was not. The sister didn't end up with Candida. She did. She finally got rid of that, stopped living in a massive psychosis, the need to control every part of your life, and she suddenly no longer had the disease. Ah, so stress impacts menstrual disorders, premature ejaculations in men, impotency, all stress. So the next time you want a good vitamin, don't look at the vitamin to de-stress you. Look at changing perceptions. Back in a moment.
Amigo, por comer la vereda.
like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. This is a series of short informational articles that are meant to counter some of this mass hysteria and psychoses that radiation will not impact us in any negative way because it's been diluted. And that's the scientist telling us that. That's playing upon, once again, our fear. Here's the reality. From Global Research, Stop the War Coalition depleted uranium, and that's what's on every one of those bombs over there. Quote from David Wilson. In the first 24 hours of the Libyan attack, U.S. B-52s dropped 45 2,000-pound bombs. These massive bombs, along with the cruise missiles launched by the British and French planes and ships, all contain depleted uranium warheads. Depleted uranium is the waste product from the process of enriching uranium ore. It is used in nuclear weapons and reactors because it is a very heavy substance, 1.7 times denser than lead. It is highly valued by the military for its ability to punch through armored vehicles and buildings. When a weapon made with depleted uranium strikes a solid object like a side of a tank, it goes straight through it, then erupts into a burning cloud of vapor. The vapor settles as dust, which is not only poisonous but radioactive. For how long? About 3 billion years. An impacting depleted uranium missile burns at 10,000 degrees centigrade. When it strikes a target, 30% fragments are shrapnel. The remaining 70% vaporizes into 3 highly toxic oxides, including uranium oxide. The black dust remains suspended in the air and, according to wind and weather, can travel, well, thousands of miles. Every single square inch of Iraq and Afghanistan have been permeated with this. Now, particles less than 5 microns in diameter are easily inhaled and can remain in your lungs and other organs for your whole lifetime. It's like having a little chest x-ray going off in every one of the organs where these 5 or less micron diameter oxides reside. They can cause kidney damage, cancers of the lung and bone, skin disorders, neurocognitive disorders, chromosome damage, immune deficiency syndrome, rare kidney and bowel diseases, and pregnant women. Big problem there, because you're going to end up giving birth to infants with genetic defects. I have 5,000 photographs of babies from one hospital near Fallujah that were impacted by depleted uranium. They are horrible to look at. I put them in one of my films at the end. I put about 100 to show you what happens with rare cancers never before seen in Iraq, but now are absolutely common. Depleted uranium. Once again, half-life, 4.5 billion years. In the shock and awe attack on Iraq, more than 1,500 bombs and missiles were dropped on Baghdad alone. Seymour Hersh has claimed that the U.S.'s 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing alone dropped more than 500,000 tons of ordnance, all of it tipped with depleted uranium. Al Jazeera reported that invading U.S. forces fired 200 tons of radioactive material into buildings, homes, streets, gardens of Baghdad, and a reporter from the Christian Science Monitor took a Geiger counter to parts of the city that had been subjected to heavy shelling by U.S. troops. He found radiation levels 1,900 times higher than normal in residential areas. With a population of 26 million, the U.S. dropped a one-ton bomb for every 52 Iraqi civilians, or 40 pounds of explosives per person. And that's what we just put as our way of helping the people in Libya. We have yet to acknowledge officially, no president, no member of the government has acknowledged the damage or danger of depleted uranium. We have the leading expert for the army who was sent over there to measure and detoxify it, and Dr. Roike, and he has repeatedly on this program and in articles I've written shown the damage of this, and this is one of the contributing factors to Gulf War syndrome. But what we're doing to the children and pregnant women and their developing fetuses in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Yemen is horrible. Also, depleted uranium doesn't go away. It will never go away, ever. It goes into the soil. Then the foods that you grow, it's in the food that you eat. Then it's in the water you drink. You can't filter it out. You can't get rid of it. And so, once again, we deal with this mass psychosis. Simply deny that it exists. Okay, it doesn't exist. Tell us, New York Times. Tell us, Anderson Cooper. When was the last time you did an expose of depleted uranium? How about never? Why? Because it's not important? Major importance. Suffering from that split. Now, from Ira Heflin, there is no safe level of radiation exposure. From Common Dreams, as the radioactive contamination of food, water, and soil in Japan worsens, the media is continuously reassuring us that these levels are safe. But there is no safe level of radiation. Yes, at lower levels the risk is smaller, but the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences has concluded that any exposure to radiation makes it more likely that an individual will get cancer. The press is reporting that 100 millisieverts, or MSVs, is the lowest dose that increases cancer risks. They are wrong. Absolutely, totally wrong. According to the National Academy of Sciences' own paper, that you can have a 1 in 100 chance of getting cancer at the 100 MSV level, but a dose of 10 MSV still gives you a 1 in 1,000 chance of getting cancer, and a dose of just one single MSV gives you a chance of getting cancer at 1 in 10,000. Okay, then look at how many people are in the area. Well, for example, in around Tokyo, you have 30 million. So that means an awful lot of people are going to get cancer. But what about the people getting it in the United States from those winds? That'll also cause cancer. And what do we do here about Indian Point, 24 miles north of New York City? We have over 20 million people living within an area that would be 100% polluted within 2 hours. If wind blows at, let's say, 12 miles an hour, and it blows south, southeast, southwest, then in 2 hours, everyone living in that area, northeast area of New Jersey, southern Connecticut, New York, are going to be affected by radiation at much higher doses. And yet, what's being done about it? How about nothing? From the Right Livelihood Laureates, these are the alternative to the Nobel Prize, all of them signed a petition, "We demand global nuclear phase-out." I'll quote just the first page. "We extend our deepest sympathies to the people of Japan who have experienced a devastating earthquake and tsunami followed by severe damage to their nuclear power station. We commend the brave individuals who are risking their lives to prevent the escape of massive amounts of radiation from the damaged nuclear reactors and spent fuel rods. The disaster in Japan has demonstrated once again the limits of human capability to keep dangerous technologies free from accidents with catastrophic results. Natural disasters combined with human error have proven a potent force for undermining even the best laid plans. Reliance on human perfection reflects a hubris that has led to other major failures of dangerous technologies in the past and will do so in the future. What has occurred as a result of the confluence of natural disaster and human error in Japan could also be triggered purposefully by means of terrorism or acts of war. In addition to accidental or purposeful destruction, nuclear power plants pose other threats to humanity and the human future. The large amounts of radioactive waste that are created by nuclear power generation will remain highly toxic for thousands of years. And there's currently no long-term solution to dealing with the threats these radioactive wastes pose to the environment or human health. Further, nuclear power plants, with their large societal subsidies, have diverted financial and human resources from the development of safe and reliable and renewable energy forms. Nuclear power programs use and create fissile materials that can be used to make nuclear weapons and thus provide a proven pathway to nuclear weapons proliferation. Several countries have already used civilian nuclear programs to provide the fission materials to make nuclear weapons. Other countries, particularly those with plutonium reprocessing and uranium enrichment facilities, could easily follow suit if they decided to. Nuclear power is neither the answer to modern energy problems nor a panacea for climate change challenges. There is no solution to problems by creating more problems. Nuclear power doesn't add up economically, environmentally, or societally. Of all the energy options, nuclear is the most capital-intensive to establish. Decommissioning is prohibitively expensive, and the financial burden continues long after the plant is closed. And then it has all the hundreds of signatories to that. So my suggestion is, let us start a campaign to close down all the nuclear facilities in the United States. Now for our issue of the day, and then I will take a break, come back, and it's your turn to share your points of view. First, the war on science. When the news broke last week of the request for Professor William Cronin's email after his New York Times op-ed piece suggests that Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker's behavior was contrary to the state's history of neighborliness, decency, and mutual respect, I was reminded of that old line from World War II survivors that begins with the words, "First they came for." It is a phrase and analogy which has been perhaps too often used to decry unjust political conduct by raising the specter of fear of imminent harm. But this time, Professor Cronin's case, I think it is appropriate, and here's why. First they came for the scientist, the evolutionary biologist who dared to suggest that the planet was more than 6,000 years old and that Adam and Eve did not live peacefully or coexist with dinosaurs. They were forbidden from teaching evolution without also giving equal time and attention to alternative explanations. Then they came for the climatologist who dared to suggest that corporations and complicit governments were poisoning the planet, and unless we cleaned up our carbon addiction, our actions threaten to unleash an ecological Armageddon in the foreseeable future. As Paul Krugman wrote in his column, back in 2009, climate skeptics got hold of more than 1,000 emails between researchers at the Climate Research Unit at Britain's University of East Anglia. Nothing in the correspondence suggested any kind of scientific impropriety. At most, we learned, I know this will shock you, that scientists are human beings who occasionally say snide things about people they dislike. But that didn't stop the usual suspects from claiming that they had uncovered ClimateGate, a scientific scandal that somehow invalidates the vast array of evidence for man-made climate change. Then they came for the K-12 school teachers, who were blamed for all manner of failure, including the widely circulated and deeply flawed results of the PISA test, the Program for International Study Assessment. These scores do not take into account the populations that some schools serve, nor are the right-wingers who point to the results ever likely to admit that comparing the diverse school population of the United States to the homogeneous populations in Finland is a realistic way to appraise learning or teaching. More importantly, I don't know or never have known a teacher who didn't want to improve education or get rid of those few colleagues who didn't measure up. But having students fail when they are from homes that don't stress education, or have parents who don't participate in homework, or are situated in communities that don't provide resources to enable schools to do their jobs, is not all the alleged harm that teachers do. As all good Christian right-wingers know, what really goes on in public schools from sea to shining sea is the open promotion of homosexuality and the required reading of all those leftist novels, including those dangerous Harry Potter books. That's the problem, huh? Then they came for college professors in general, for being, well, liberals. As Jonathan Knight, president of the AAUP, puts it, it's hard to see that these liberal views cut very deeply into the education of students. In fact, a number of studies show the core values that students bring into the university are not much altered at all by college. So, although there is no evidence whatsoever of college professors affecting students' core values, the right is convinced that just being in the same classroom with a liberal is likely to inflict harm. If you read your Holocaust history, you'll find exactly the same sentiments expressed by Nazis about the good German students being in the same classroom with Jews. Then they came for Professor Cronin, for speaking out about behavior that he sees as contrary to the values of the majority of the population and the political history of the state of Wisconsin. And so, this is what it all comes down to, my friends. Either we volunteer for service to our country's best interests in this ongoing battle of narratives that dominates our political landscape, or we stay home, remain silent, and content with ourselves with our own cowardice. As my wife puts it, academics are notorious woozies in the face of conflict, which, by the way, is something the right counts on. But sooner or later, the knock on your door, or the request for your email, or the summons to account for your teaching or writing won't be one you can ignore, because when that happens, they have come for you. From Professor Bud Goodell, who's a professor out in Arizona, and he teaches progressive academics. And finally, one other narrative here from Richard Becker, The Myth of Humanitarian Intervention, Libya. This is very short, but it's important. What is the United States doing to protect those civilians? Wounded protesters being treated in Sana'a, Yemen's, that's the capital, on March 19th, the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, U.S., British, and French planes began bombing Libya, launching a new war against yet another Arab country. 2 days earlier, the U.N. Security Council, under intense pressure from the U.S. and its allies, voted the Resolution 1973. The day after the Security Council vote, armed forces of Ali Salih government in Yemen carried out a massacre. The massacre took place in broad daylight at the central square in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. At least 52 people were killed and more than 200 wounded, most of the snipers firing from atop government buildings. Despite the use of live ammunition by snipers, tens of thousands of demonstrators who have been demanding the ouster of U.S.-backed president came to the square. What was the reaction of the U.S. government to the March 18th massacre in Yemen? Clinton disingenuously stated the U.S. government is alarmed by the violence. No calls from Washington for UN-imposed no-fly zone or the bombing of the Yemen's military. Not even a whisper from the Washington about sanctions. On the contrary, U.S. military and other aid continue to flow unimpeded to the ruling monarchy and his army. On March 16th, the government of Bahrain, with the assistance of 2,000 invading Saudi troops and hundreds of United Arab Emirates security forces, dispersed the mass protests in the capital, Manama, and elsewhere. The government of all three countries are hereditary monarchies and police states, long subservient to the U.S. and British imperialism. According to a White House statement, President Obama called the three rulers, including Abdullah of Saudi Arabia and Al-Khalifa of Bahrain, to express his deep concern. As in the case of Yemen, no threats of military intervention, sanctions, or anything else that they had to face, in spite of the blatant invasion and brutal repression. More than 20 Bahrainians had been killed at that point. What explains Washington's mild response to developments in Yemen and Bahrain while it is at the same time launching a new war against Libya? The answer is that while the Gaddafi government in Libya has, under pressure, made many concessions to imperialism and opened the country's economy to in recent years, it has not been a client regime. After hedging its bets in the initial stages of the Libyan conflict, Obama administered its straight effect. This decision has nothing to do with claimed reasons. We are not there because of democracy, human rights, civilian suffering, and so on. The leaders in Washington, the Democrats as well as Republicans, have proven over many decades their willingness not only to tolerate but promote, in numerous cases, create the most repressive and vicious regimes in the world. Take Saudi Arabia, for example. The British and U.S. Army and Marines and Air Force and Navy funded one extended family, the Al Sauds, in their drive to conquer most of the Arabian Peninsula. The country was founded in 1932, and its name literally means the Arabia of the Al Saud family, hence Saudi Arabia. Today it is ruled by 2,000 princes. They are never elected. The country has no history of ever having an election. Women are denied the right even to drive cars, and the slightest sign of political dissent is met with immediate torture, imprisonment, and execution. But in Washington, and the corporate media here, Saudi Arabia is treated as a modern, friendly state. The fact is, Saudi Arabia holds over 25% of the world's known oil reserves, and while the royal family has grown very rich, U.S. oil companies and banks and military-industrial corporations, the core of U.S. ruling class have reaped even greater wealth. What moved the Obama administration to take action was a realization that the leaders of Libyan opposition, who pleaded loudly for imperialist intervention, would better serve these same powerful interests if they were to become the new government of Libya. End quote. Your thoughts? Our phone number, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Those are our two issues. Address either. Thank you. Back in a moment. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. My guest is standing by, and we're going to go to him in a moment or two, but I wanted you to have a chance to call in and share your points of view. So let's say hello to Eddie from Hackensack. Hi, Eddie. You're on the line.
Hi, Gary. How are you today?
Good.
Gary, I'm such a big fan, and right again, your commentary was so spot on. It's scary obvious. But what I wanted to say is that I did write an essay as you proposed, and I came up with a problem and a solution, if you have a second to hear it.
Oh, I don't have time for the essay now, but if you would,
No, not the whole essay, just a nutshell.
Okay, a nutshell.
The title of my essay is called The Corporate Draft Lottery, and essentially it says, you know, if we can take human beings in a draft with no questions asked and send them to fight a war to the playing field, currently I think our war is with the economy, so I propose to take the 200 poorest cities in America and the 200 most earningest former companies that used to do business in America, and we're going to have a draft, just like the NFL does, to equal the playing field and create a parity. So let's say, for example, Detroit, we're going to put all these corporations in a sack, and if we pull a Pepsi-Cola, say Pepsi-Cola, guess what? You have to go build a plant in Detroit, and there's no questions asked. It's just like a draft, like anything else.
Well, Eddie, hold on a second. Send me the essay so I can read it, okay? But there's problems because you can't force any person, because we don't have a draft day. If we did, we wouldn't be in Iraq or Afghanistan. But you couldn't force a corporation to insist where it does business and how it does business. That wouldn't fly. We have to be practical within our system. But I'd like to read your essay. Let's say hello to Sarah from Rockland County. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, Gary, how are you?
Good.
Gary, a friend of mine from California, a holistic, active, 45-year-old woman, is suffering with radiation poisoning from the smart meters that they are posting in front of people's kitchen and windows. They're supposed to take the place of meter readers. They measure the electrical capacities in the home, but they're expressing microwaves that have caused my poor friend to be really overweighed and over-electrocuted, and has high levels of measurement of radiation as a result. She's had to leave her position as an active therapist and try to find a place in the outer reaches of California, is living completely alone and trying to find a way to get some healing to live.
Okay, do this, Sarah. Send me all the details. Just send me an email with all the information you can get about your friend, her condition, and I'll be happy to see what I can do to help. We're going to take one more. Let's say hello to Lewis from Staten Island.
Hello, Gary, a pleasure to talk to you. I wanted to say that I feel very passionately about the progressive issues about which you speak, and I have no political comment, but I'm one of many, I'm sure I'm one of many listeners and viewers who want to become active in some way, and I've committed to making contributions to political leaders like Dennis Kucinich or boldprogressive.org whenever I see that they're mounting a campaign that is in line with the kind of things that you're talking about. So you know, I think that there is a way we can get involved and not just collect information. I've given, you know, money any number of times to Kucinich this year, and especially after yesterday's, when you announced that he had, was introducing a bill to limit or to defund the invasion of Libya.
Okay, Lewis, here's my suggestion. This Sunday at 1 o'clock, I'll be having a meeting for those who are progressive, who would like to look at some issues that we could all agree, no matter what your political or ideological background, need to be addressed, and then look at what can we do to get good information and then get this information in a way that is accessible to people and understandable to people, because we're dealing with incomplete information, biased information, tainted information, and so people, reasonable people, are frequently making unreasonable choices because they've been given misinformation, including on radiation. So if we're going to have the meeting, and a call, I'm going to give you a number to call. It's Jason's number, 646-926-5428, if you'd like to join us on that initial discussion for progressive minds on these issues. Thank you. And I'm sorry I can't take any other calls. Let's go over and say hello to David Sirota, S-I-R-O-T-A. He used to be a syndicated columnist with the Denver Post, San Francisco Chronicle, radio host on the Clear Channel based in Denver. And he also is a popular rabble-rouser, which is a good thing. He is also the editor or the author of Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now. Nice to have you with us again, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, having been raised in the early boomer generation and the political angst and idealism and social and spiritual explorations, and sometimes I feel that the 1980s was a blink, especially in pop and entertainment culture. And yes, as I'm sure that you also feel, much of the radical idealism of the 60s and 70s morphed into what became yuppie culture and the me-first, self-cherishing pursuit of self-gratification that seems to have only intensified through the 80s and 90s and into today. So would you begin, please, by addressing the simple question with a likely complex answer. Why should we try to learn from the lessons of the 80s? And when we speak of a predominant worldview that permeates American society at this moment, what are the key characteristics that you can trace to the 1980s?
It's a good question, and I want to be clear. I'm not advocating the lessons of the 1980s. I look at how many of the storylines that we tell ourselves today to explain our world to ourselves today come straight out of the 1980s. And I'm glad you mentioned the 1960s. One of the first chapters in the book is about how the 1980s really, I argue, through both the Reagan political culture and entertainment culture, movies, TV, television, television shows and the like, reimagined what the 50s and what the 60s mean in the American psyche. And as I show, what the 80s really did was suggest that the 50s was this great time of national unity and patriotism, and kind of wiped away in our memory, in many people's memory, what the 1950s was also, which was a time of religious bigotry and racial bigotry and a terrible time for women's rights and the like. And at the same time, the 1980s pop and political culture also sold us this idea that all the progress of the 1960s on those very issues of bigotry and equality, that the 1960s really wasn't about that. The 1960s was just about chaos and assassinations and violence and decadence and overzealous idealism, unrealistic idealism. And of course, this is what continues to dominate these two narratives from the 80s. The 80s version of the 50s, the 80s version of the 60s is what continues to dominate our political discourse today. Tea Party folks quite often talk about taking the country back to the 50s, and what they're really talking about is not back necessarily to the actual 1950s, but to the 80s version of the 1950s, and they've constantly waged a war, the right has, on the 80s version of the 1960s. So I think that's one thing that traces straight back to the 1980s. I also think that our idea that war and militarism is the way to solve all problems clearly has a lot of its roots in the 1980s. Now, some people may say, well, we've always been a belligerent or bellicose country, but actually, at the beginning of the 1980s, 50% of Americans, according to Gallup's poll, in 1981, were saying that they had serious doubts about militarism, about the military, didn't have confidence in military decision makers. By the end of the 1980s, that same poll showed 85% of Americans had full confidence in the military, and the numbers stayed there ever since. So what intervened in between those two data points was, again, a pop in political culture that said that the military should be the central institution in our society. I mean, this is everything from Rambo to Top Gun to Ronald Reagan himself saying that the only thing a responsible society should do is get out of the way of the military. Let the troops win, as both Ronald Reagan and John Rambo said. And then I think also one other thing I would throw out there is that I have a whole series of chapters on narcissism and selfishness and the idea that greed is good. The 80s really went a long way to inculcating America to the idea that the individual was more important than the common good, than we're all in this together. You see that in the Nike campaigns of Just Do It, of deifying Michael Jordan, deifying the individual. You see that in data about attitudes of college freshmen. In the beginning of the 1980s, most college freshmen said they were going to college to find a meaningful philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, most college freshmen saying they were going to college primarily to make a lot of money. The numbers have stayed there ever since. So there was really a greed is good ethos that was sold in the 1980s and that remains with us today.
The greed is good from Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. How do you see Obama and his group of Rahm Emanuel, Timothy Geithner, and also Lawrence Summers? Virtually all the people he had around him were part of that greed is good group.
Absolutely. And I think that what's, I think, baffling to many people is that Barack Obama on the campaign said that he wanted to be a transformational president like Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was a transformational president. And Ronald Reagan was a transformational president precisely because of what I outlined in the book. While I disagreed with Ronald Reagan on almost everything, he was transformational in the sense that he was echoing these relatively new narratives in that I just described in American culture and making them stick. They were relatively new. What Barack Obama has done, and I think it's unfortunate, is he simply echoed many of those narratives. He's played within many of those narratives. Instead of challenging the entire paradigm that greed is good, he has tried to say, well, greed may not be great, but greed is still good, and we can tinker around the edges at best on economic policy within the paradigm of greed is good. Same thing with militarism. I mean, this is not a president who has challenged the fundamental paradigm of 80s style militarism. He's really said, well, I still believe in militarism, just a slightly different version, a slightly a curtailed version, but still fundamentally the same story. So what I'm trying to say here is that Reagan was transformational in introducing narratives to the country that hadn't stuck before, and Barack Obama has not been similarly transformational because he has not fundamentally challenged those narratives and storylines that came out of the 1980s.
Well, there's nothing original about Barack Obama. Barack Obama is Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan in drag. This guy has everything that they did. He is pro-business. He says, and you just look at his background, he's pro-nuclear, pro-clean coal, pro-energy, more drilling. He just said it today, just said it before I went on the air. Going to open up all this new drilling, but we're going to learn the lessons. Well, there's Ronald Reagan. Learn the lessons. What lesson? Look at the largest oil disaster in history under his watch, and look at the failures of people in that administration, the previous administration, to hold the 27,000 wells that have been drilled in the Gulf to any safety standard. Once you have the people in power who are corporatized, then you don't have the power to police them. You don't.
No, I absolutely agree. And what's so eerie about it is that we are now a couple weeks away from the 25-year anniversary of the same week in which America first bombed Libya, and which the world was gripped by the nuclear meltdown in Chernobyl. That was happened almost exactly 25 years ago to the week right now. And what it shows is that we're still living in a, as I argue in my book Back to Our Future, we're living in a 1980s world. We are still repeating the same pathologies and the same mistakes of the 1980s, even though we learned we should have learned the lessons of the 1980s. And it's definitely disturbing. It's definitely upsetting. But the purpose of writing this book, of showing how we are still looking at our world through a 1980s set of lenses, is to say that it doesn't have to be that way. Is to say that it wasn't that way before the 1980s. It doesn't have to be that way after the 1980s. That what we are dealing with is a bunch of artificial frameworks. We have to use nuclear. We have to embrace greed as good. We can't curtail in any way or regulate business. Tax cuts are the solution for every economic problem. Militarism, war is the solution for every foreign policy problem. These are artificial narratives designed in the 1980s that still stick with us today, but don't have to stick with us if we become aware of how artificial they are.
David, thank you very much. This is a very important work, and I hope people take the time to read it.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Sirota, author of Back to Our Future. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.